You are listening to the Marilyn Manson Cases Podcast, the podcast discussing the accusations, lawsuits, and legal news surrounding shock rocker Marilyn Manson. Please note topics include allegations of abuse, some may find disturbing.
Hey everyone, this is Lisa from themansoncases.com, and welcome to this new episode of the Marilyn Manson Cases Podcast. Today's episode will focus on the recent rulings in Marilyn Manson's lawsuit against Evan Rachel Wood and Ashley Ilma Gore. I was able to ask attorneys and YouTubers, Steve of Southern Law and Andrea Burkhart, to answer common questions I received on social media. Take a listen.
First question we got is, could you explain what was stricken from Manson's complaint and why? FBI letter, groupie, etc. Well, I don't want to overhaul this point in too much detail since I already did a video on this specific point, and it can get quite lengthy. And I know other people are talking about it, but nevertheless, here we go. It works like this. Defendant has to show that the speech-related allegation is something that comes under the purview of the statute, the SLAPP statute, anti-SLAPP statute, a matter of public interest, petitioning the government, a statement in litigation, whatever. If so, that does not mean that the matter is stricken, that the speech is stricken or it's actually protected. It means it goes to prong two, and that's when the plaintiff, in this case Manson, has to show some evidence that the speech as it is, how it affected him, would sustain a verdict against the defendant or defendants if the evidence were true. So you got to show that the speech is actionable and there's enough evidence that it would result in a verdict, and then it can go forward. If not, it's not a merit-based claim, and it'd be struck. So anyway, since prong one, which is what is covered under it, is pretty broad, most of the fighting is on prong two. In short, then, on prong two, the court found on the letter that there was not evidence it was used outside the litigation, the custody of litigation, to cause emotional distress. It certainly was used inside that litigation, but the court said, you didn't give me something to show how it was used outside of that litigation to actually cause you emotional distress. On the record, as it existed in front of the judge, that's what she decided. On the recruiting, pressuring, the court found that there was not evidence that the statements made by Wood Gore in the record were extreme and outrageous to the degree necessary for intentional infliction of emotional distress in terms of pressuring people to make false allegations. So for an IIED claim, you're not just got to show some evidence that what you're saying they did is true, but also that it rises to the legal standard of being extreme and outrageous beyond the bounds of a civilized society. Did they do that in terms of pressuring people to make false allegations? Now, obviously, declining to consider the Smithline Declaration was a blow to Manson on this one for sure. That's something I'm sure will be in his appeal. On groupie, there was not evidence that Gore had serious doubts about the truth of what she was saying, which is required for a defamation claim against a public figure because you have to have this actual malice. And as to Wood, in addition, the court didn't see that there was evidence that she concurred in Gore's statements to sustain a claim of civil conspiracy. In my, you know, appeal video and some of the other stuff, I gave my thoughts on the accuracy of that or not. Now, I know, of course, some people don't agree with some of this that the judge decided or all of it. But the question that was asked to me is why the court ordered as it did, not whether it's right. For greater details, as I've said, I've put out some videos. Andrea has done some videos that are in detail, and there are others. So find the one you like. Choose your own ending.
What was stricken from Manson's complaint were allegations and causes of action relating to the FBI letter, the claim that groupie involved, you know, child pornography, and the coordination of the accusers providing checklists and scripts and so forth. So the specific causes of action that were stricken were essentially two grounds for intentional infliction of emotional distress, but not all of the grounds for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And the claim for defamation has also been stricken. What remains after the anti-slap? First, allegations that Ilma Gore created some fake email accounts pretending to be Marilyn Manson, using them to email pornography that they believe is prohibited because the URLs have since been taken down, and using them to create basically fake-looking communications with others. Also, the allegation that Ilma Gore swatted Marilyn Manson by calling in a false, basically, welfare check under her own name. And then allegations that Ilmagore had hacked into his computer files and social media accounts. She apparently got the login information from Ashley Walters, his former assistant, basically used that to get access to private information in those accounts. And so those allegations together are in support of causes of action that remain for intentional infliction of emotional distress, for violation of the Comprehensive Computer Data and Access Fraud Act, which is part of the California Penal Code, and then impersonation over the internet, which is also a California criminal statute that gives a private right of action. So they're still asking for specific damages amount to be proven at trial, as well as punitives, costs and attorney fees if they can get them, and an injunction against further such behavior towards Marilyn Manson.
I didn't fill in notes in here, but of course that is the swatting that's still in there, the impersonating and the hacking. Those things are all still in there, plus a little bit of the contentions that, you know, there were false allegations against him. That's what was not stricken. But obviously material parts of his lawsuit were stricken.
Question three, could you explain judicial notice? So judicial notice is a doctrine that basically says that it would be a waste of time to have to prove every single fact under the sun in a court action. Some things are so obvious or so well established or just unlikely to be disputed that the judge isn't going to force you to bring in specific evidence to make that point. And so an example would be something like humans need oxygen to survive. Okay, you don't probably need to call a doctor to testify to that if for some reason that's a critical issue that needs to be established in your case. So it's commonly used for things like legislative enactments, which is what it was used for in this case with the Phoenix Act. So the fact that that legislation exists, not really a matter in significant dispute. So that's essentially what that means.
So that's really something that's presented to the court or that the court takes notice of without having to go through proof. An example like, what time does the sun set? Or a statute somewhere. And in this case, maybe it's good to know, I think, if a court takes judicial notice of another lawsuit, say the complaint in that lawsuit, it doesn't mean it's taken as true the allegations in the complaint. It can get tricky as to what judicial notice means in terms of whether they're accepting the facts or just the fact that another lawsuit was filed and these were the allegations in it.
Question four, was the judge able to consider the evidence from the broken iPad at all for anti-slap? I'm not sure I know the answer to this question. I'm going to do my best to take a stab at it because what I'm not sure about is if it is relating to some of the objections, which I did not go through and like sort out what all that stuff was. So if that's the case, I'm sorry, I don't know. But if it's just in general, the judge is going to consider whatever the parties submitted as their evidence with their motions, basically. So any additional exhibits that they may have lodged, we saw, for example, a couple notices of lodging that got filed. Otherwise, there were, you know, things that were submitted with declarations as part of their evidence.
She could have. Manson says she did not, and that's going to be part of his appeal.
Question five, how could the FBI letter be considered free speech or protected activity? Well, this was very much the intriguing part of this decision to me, just because it seems so counterintuitive. So the answer is the reason that the FBI letter was treated as protected activity is because Evan Rachel Wood filed it in court. You have a right to petition the government for redresses. You get to use the government processes available to you. That is protected by the First Amendment. So that's her argument. Manson tried to argue that, you know, it's not the fact that she filed it that matters. It's really just the fact that she did it at all. And her counter to that was, yeah, but if it never saw the light of day, then it can't support a cause of action for emotional distress because you would have never known about it. It couldn't have affected you. And they never had proof of Evan Rachel Wood or Ilma Gore, anybody showing this letter to anybody else. It really would have been nice if they could get that link to the Daily Mail publication. You know, it had the watermark from Evan Rachel Woods's law firm. But certainly in California has a reporter's privilege. You can't compel them to give up the source of their information. So you can't say for sure, you know, how and where the Daily Mail got that unless somebody admits to it. That would have been, you know, a potential way around it, but the law is not favorable to them to be able to find that out. So anyway, because they didn't have proof that it had been published to anybody else was aware of it, it couldn't be used to support a cause of action. So it necessarily, any wrong would have had to come from her filing it in court. And so filing things in court is protected activity. So then Manson turns around, quite understandably, and says, yes, but that's illegal. It's illegal to forge a document and file it in your court case. And the issue with that is simply that because of this anti-SLAPP context, they're trying to be protective of speech. It means that they are going to basically assume that it is permitted unless they can show that it's uncontested or undisputed that it's illegal. There's no factual dispute about it at all. And so given that that's the standard, the fact that Evan Rachel Wood submits a declaration where she says, "Nah, I didn't do that," that is enough to establish, to overcome this objection to her being able to invoke the First Amendment. So then the analysis moves on. The way this anti-SLAPP analysis works, there's two parts to it. First question is, does this involve a protected activity at all? And then if the answer to that is yes, if it does, which the court found here, then is there a probability that the plaintiff can win? Can they win on this protected speech claim? Can they show that it's unprotected? Can they show that, for whatever reason, it's something that they're allowed to recover for? And so in this particular case, then they said, no, you can't. You're not going to be able to prove that she filed a fake FBI letter in her custody case because you're not allowed to do that because of litigation privilege. Litigation privilege is this doctrine that says that you have essentially near absolute immunity for anything you do in a court case. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be criminally charged for stuff. Again, perjury is a crime. You know, you can be held accountable for that. But in terms of giving another person a right to sue you, a private civil cause of action, can't get that from court actions. The only exception to that is a cause of action for malicious prosecution. If somebody, you know, causes you to be falsely charged, or somebody files a false lawsuit against you or something like that, you can bring a malicious prosecution case. And that's pretty much the only exception. So that's why, for example, you know, Amber Heard repeating all of her allegations in the court in Fairfax, you know, he can't sue her for saying that in her testimony because she said it as part of the court process. So she gets privilege for being able to say those things in that context. So that is the basis of the ruling. He's not allowed to prove that she filed an illegal FBI, you know, forged letter in her custody case to support his private civil cause of action because litigation privilege does not permit it.
How could the FBI letter be considered free speech or protected activity? And it's a good question. Because it's in litigation. For example, you can't sue somebody for defamation for what they say as a witness in a trial. it's privilege for that purpose for these ancillary lawsuits. Now you could, you know, go after somebody for perjury or whatever if you were in that case. Or, you know, as people say, well, what about this being illegal? Certainly law enforcement could do something about it. And there, you know, there can be situations where the privilege is removed. You're asking, how could it happen? And it could happen because it was made in the course of litigation.
Question six, the judge isn't determining the validity of the letter being fake. I may have answered this in my last answer. I don't know. But no, the judge is not determining whether the letter is fake or not. The judge is basically ruling at this point that the letter is not going to be valid evidence to support a cause of action in California. And so because of that, he can't file a claim. He can't put allegations in his lawsuit relating to the filing of the FBI letter because it will not be admissible. Her filing it was privileged.
Question six, could you explain the FBI letter in the sense that, from whoever this is understanding, the judge isn't determining the validity of the letter being fake? And that's correct. The judge didn't have to reach any conclusion on the FBI letter being fake or not. I mean, it's clearly fake. There's really no other conclusion to have about it. The only point of discussing whether Wood did it or not is that if illegality is controverted, in other words, there's a contention over it, it's not just shown absolutely or conceded by the defendant, then illegality won't take the statement outside of the scope of this litigation privileges for purposes of SLAPP as the judge sees it. And then without it being used, as the judge found, by the defendants outside of the custody litigation to cause emotional distress, then that's why it gets struck. That's the logic.
Question seven, the groupie ruling. So the first part of the groupie ruling was a finding that it constituted protected speech based on a matter of substantial public interest. And so basically what the court said is, society has an interest in being able to protect children from sex abuse, from being able to alert people to potential predators and things like that. And so because society has that interest, you give that speech greater protection. And that means that you have a much more relaxed standard for being wrong. It's okay to be wrong in those types of situations as long as you are not maliciously wrong. So because of that, generally speaking, that category of speech, talking about who is and who isn't a child sex predator, is going to be considered protected speech. Now, it obviously might not be in any particular instance. And in this particular instance as well, it might not be. So then it moves on to the question of, can Manson prevail on the merits on this claim? Has he presented enough evidence to show that he's going to be able to establish this is not protected speech, this is defamatory, this is going to meet the requirements of those causes of action? So with respect to Evan Rachel Wood, the judge just basically ruled you don't have enough evidence to prove that there was a conspiracy here. Everything kind of has to do with Ilma Gore and what she did or didn't do. And so because of that, you don't have enough evidence to be able to establish that Evan Rachel Wood was implicated in that. So her motion was granted on that particular ground. With Ilma Gore, since, of course, she made the statements, there's no question about her complicity in that particular cause of action. So she doesn't get it thrown out on the conspiracy grounds. But the court still then turns to this question of, can Manson prove basically all of the elements of defamation? Does he have enough evidence to be able to take that to the jury at this point in time? And so the judge basically looked at the evidence and it came down to actual malice. Did Ilma Gore, at the time that she allegedly made these statements to Michelle Meyer about, you know, underage women being involved in the filming, did she actually know that that was true? Did she know that she was saying things that were not true, that Jeanette Pollard was in the movie, that kind of thing? And so the judge basically ruled that he didn't meet that standard. I have to tell you, I do not agree with this ruling. And the reason why is because she basically relied on Ilmagore's statements. Ilmagore, you know, said, oh, I received this random phone call from somebody who claimed to be a relative of Jeanette and said that she was in groupie. And I mean, some, to my ear, highly incredible story about how she supposedly got this information. And also that I guess Manson hadn't proved that Pollard was not in the movie. I'm pretty sure they did say she wasn't in the movie. But anyway, the reason why that's a problem is because they're not really supposed to be weighing the evidence in this stage, right? Where you're like, well, he says this, but she says this. Which one do I believe? That's not the role of anti-slap. You're basically looking primarily at Marilyn Manson's evidence and saying, is this going to get us over the bar? Is there enough here that a jury could find this if they believe everything? And then they're only looking at the opposing party's evidence to evaluate, do they have something there that just kills the claim absolutely as a matter of law? Not do they have evidence that might create a factual question that a jury would need to decide. And to me, that's what Ilmagore's statements about, you know, claiming that she got the phone call from the relative and stuff like that. Those are just creating factual disputes. Those are to go to the jury and decide, do I believe that or not? Okay, the jury is entitled to decide, yes, I believe it. No, I think that's a bunch of shit. So that is how the judge reached that decision. But as I've said, I don't agree with that. I think that that was not correct. I think that is something that potentially could be vulnerable on appeal.
Question 7, could you explain how the judge ruled on groupie a little bit more? I was confused about how the judge was able to use what Ilma said at face value about, this stuff about face value about, you know, what's true and what's not true. That's a problem because to show the actual malice, you've got to show that she had serious doubts, and that's a subjective thing. And, you know, if she listened to various people tell her what they thought was in this video and it was convincing to her, and that's, you know, it's a problem for Manson. And it's a little bit of how the judge applied the legal standard there. So I guess the corollary to that, the other way to look at it is, was there evidence that Gore didn't believe that that video had a minor in it? I mean, where did Gore say, I don't really think it has a minor in it? And if your only angle is to say, well, she should have investigated more, that's going to be an uphill climb by case law, I think. But it may be, you know, a hill that Manson's going to try to get up. Okay, one more aside here. As a side note, I've seen someone comment, groupie could only be a matter of public interest if the assumptions were right. I don't agree with that. The issue is what Gore said, okay? And if what she said was in a matter of public interest, then that's what needs to get tested. Whether the thing she was talking about actually was that or not is a separate topic. And I think for purposes of this motion, it should be assumed that Manson is correct on that, there was not a minor in it. And then it moves over to, well, it's still a topic of whether there was a minor being abused, and that is of public interest. And then whether Gore had these serious doubts or not, at least that's how it played out in the motion.
What causes of action are staying and what was dismissed? So the original complaint had 4 causes of action. Intentional infliction of emotional distress committed 5 different ways. Defamation, violation of the Comprehensive Computer Data and Access Fraud Act, which is a California criminal statute that creates a private civil cause of action. And similarly, impersonation over the internet. That's also a California criminal statute. So what was stricken by the anti-slap was the defamation cause of action and 3 of the grounds for the intentional infliction of emotional distress. So that means that what remains are 2 bases for intentional infliction of emotional distress: the violation of the Computer Data and Access Fraud Act and the impersonation over the internet are still going forward after the anti-slap.
Well, the impersonating is still in, the hacking is still in, the defamation is gone, The infliction of emotional distress is still in on swatting and hacking, but not the FBI letter, defamation, or recruiting. That's how I see this kind of confusing order.
Could or should Manson start his lawsuit over again? Well, I suspect this is a question that comes from a desire to see him find a more favorable jurisdiction than California that would not have this type of anti-slap law that would get in the way of what seemed to common sense intuitively be fairly reasonable claims of wrongdoing. But the problem is, well, there's a few problems. One, to be able to sue somebody in any particular jurisdiction, you have to have a basis for that. There has to be a reason why it's appropriate in that particular court. And so the reason why this landed in California in the first place is because that's where pretty much everything happened, at least at some point in the recent past, they had been living there. So those tend to be the main reasons why you end up with jurisdiction in a particular place. So theoretically now Evan's in Tennessee, Ilma I think is in Florida. Could he go and sue them over there? I mean, maybe. The big problem that he runs into at this point is you run into a statute of limitations problem. And so basically every jurisdiction is going to have a limited length of time to be able to bring claims against another person. So he's certainly butting up, if not past that, in California already. It's a 2-year statute of limitations for intentional infliction of emotional distress. I think it might be less for some of the others, but it would depend on the jurisdiction that he was trying to move to, what their statute of limitations is. It could be longer, but it could be shorter. And then you also just have the added risk that if the only reason you're in that court is because the person lives there, it's potentially grounds for jurisdiction to be imposed. That's not necessarily a guarantee that the forum state law is what is going to apply. Sometimes because everything took place in California, you might be applying California law. It really complicates things and that increases the risk. So the risk is you drop your case in California, you refile it in Tennessee. Tennessee throws it out because they don't have jurisdiction. Well, now you're past statute of limitations everywhere. You can't go back to California where you started because your 2 years are done. So I don't really see that as a viable strategy. It's not theoretically impossible, but just as a practical matter, I don't think that's something he's likely to pursue.
No. Well, I mean, he'd like to, right? But the Supreme Court of California in Varian Medical Systems versus Delfino, 35 Cal 4th, 180, 2005, Supreme Court of California said the granting of a motion to strike for slap purposes is a dismissal on the merits. And so when a case is decided on the merits, res judicata typically prevents you from bringing the same claim again. Otherwise, people would just file the same lawsuit over and over and over again until they finally got what they wanted. And they don't let that happen. So I do not think you can just get beat here by this judge and then just file it again. The remedy at this point is the appeal. That's why they have the immediate appeal process.
Briefly explain the appeal and what we might expect. So the appeal is the opportunity for Manson to have a panel of judges review this judge's reasoning. Basically, look at the law that she's relied on, look at how she has applied the law, and evaluate if she did that correctly. And so because this is anti-slap, they allow them to do that at this stage in the case. Normally, rulings that proceed, you know, a final judgment in the case, you have to wait until the case is entirely over to be able to appeal things. And that's just because courts don't typically like to be considering the same case over and over and over again in little bits. They want to just get all of the problems over at once. But with the anti-slap, because it is so significant, it's such a significant ruling at such a preliminary stage, that they go ahead and give you the right to be able to appeal it at this point, just so that they can make sure that they get it right. What might we expect? We saw the statement from Howard King about the items that he thought maybe were appealable. He was looking at some of the rulings about the evidence that, that the court was going to consider. I have to say, those do not seem strong to me. Evidentiary rulings, judges have a lot of discretion to be able to decide what they want to consider and what they don't want to consider. And so it's a very difficult standard to basically show that this judge made a decision that no other judge would make, no reasonable thinking judge would make. So the issue here is that there kind of was a basis for the judge to make the rulings that she did. You know, we don't like it, but it's not like she had no reason. So the big one was not considering the declaration of Ashley Morgan Smithline. And the reason basically is because it was too late. They had already had a briefing schedule. They had already had the timeline to be able to submit their evidence. This came in, you know, considerably after the fact and potentially opens up, you know, a bunch of new issues if they have to do, you know, we had already gone through motions about doing discovery and stuff like that. Is this going to now cause even more delay because it has to be investigated? More depositions are going to be requested, that type of thing. The judge isn't obligated to open that door. She has the discretion to, but it's not a requirement. So given that, the fact that there is a reason, there was a schedule here and it's late, I think that's probably going to be enough to justify it under the review standard, which is very deferential. Now, when it comes to the anti-SLAPP, though, there isn't nearly that respect given to the trial judge because the appellate judges are just as capable of looking at the law and applying it. And in fact, they're probably a little bit better because that's exclusively what they do. They are not fact finders, which trial courts will typically do in addition. So appellate courts will look at the evidence, they will look at the legal standard, and they will evaluate it independently. They'll make their own decision and basically see how well that lines up with the trial judges. If it turns out that they're pretty close, then they'll probably affirm. If it turns out that they have some disagreements, then, you know, they can reverse in full or in part. And so I've already indicated I think the defamation ruling, at least as to Ilmagore, I don't think that that is valid. But having said that, I also don't know that getting a defamation judgment against Ilmagore is really Manson's top priority. You know, if that's all he can get out of an appeal, then, you know, well, who cares? When it comes to the issue of the FBI letter, I got to tell you, it doesn't look good for me on appeal. And it's not because the judge didn't make a crazy ruling here, but it's because that really does seem to be what the law says the law is. I mean, it's absolutely crazy law from my perspective. So it's not a legal error to apply a crazy law to your set of facts in front of you. So I don't think the FBI letter is likely to get overturned. And so because of that, honestly, I just don't know what great upside there potentially is from going forward with the appeal. It's kind of additional leverage, but it's kind of not because it's just dragging things out. And, you know, the real leverage here, I think, needs to be in the discovery and in the threat of trial. But, you know, obviously they're privy to a lot of information and strategy and stuff that I'm not. So I'm not trying to second guess their decision or anything like that. Just my opinion based on what I see in this case.
Can you briefly explain the appeal and what we might expect? I didn't succeed in briefly explaining it because it took about 30 minutes to do it in the video I did. And it is complicated, but let's do it quicker. The idea is to show the Court of Appeals what legal errors the trial court made on the record. I think Manson will have several items he will contend are error, ranging from excluded evidence, deposition scope, iPad stuff, Smithline declaration, to the actual legal conclusions in the order. Depending on the type of error, the appeals court will show either zero or perhaps a lot of deference to the trial court. That depends on the type of error assigned. Got that gigantic video about the specifics on it. And if you want to watch that, you can. If not, that's kind of how it goes.
Any ending thoughts? My primary ending thought is that the main thing to be keeping an eye out for at this point in time is going to be what happens when they answer. They have not had to answer the complaint yet because the anti-SLAPP basically stays them having to do that. Now that the ruling has been made, they need to file their answers. And if they file the answers, that's going to be the appropriate time to bring any counterclaim against Marilyn Manson. And the reason why I think this is very significant is because, as some of you probably know, California passed this Assembly Bill 2777, which created a window where the statute of limitations for civil claims for sex abuse basically is waived. And so claims that had been outside the statute of limitations before, going back to 2009, which is still during the relationship, those can now be filed again. So that's really going to be a real put up or shut up moment, I think, for Evan Rachel Wood. She has made a lot of noise about how difficult it is for, you know, survivors of sexual assault to be able to get justice. You know, hard to come forward and come to terms and hard to realize that what you experienced was abuse and things like that. So now she's got the opportunity. She doesn't have the excuse of, well, it's not part of the statute. It's outside the statute of limitations, so I can't do it. She doesn't even really have the dispute, the argument of, I don't want to bring it up in court. She's already being sued. I mean, you would think if you have the mountains of evidence that you claimed to government bodies that you have, that you would be eager to present that in court in order to vindicate yourself and to get that finding, even if it's just to a civil standard, that somebody wronged you. So if she does do that, then the fact that Manson kind of lost the opportunity to litigate those claims, the whole conspiracy, the hoax, he might kind of get a little bit of that win back, that opportunity back, because now he's going to get to face Evan Rachel Wood directly, and to do it not in the context of a defamation claim, right, where he's saying, you defamed me by making these accusations. The standard for that is so incredibly high. It's almost certain he wouldn't be able to clear it. But if she directly files the claim against him, accusing him of doing that, then he gets to adjudicate it on the merits. So that really is potentially advantageous to him. Certainly in the court of public opinion, it's high risk, of course, because you never really know what a jury is going to do. But nevertheless, it does give him the opportunity to go back in and deal with these allegations head on and essentially show them for the nonsense that many of us believe them to be. If she chooses not to do that, then there's going to be a lot of questions. Why wouldn't you do that? Doesn't really make a lot of sense not to do that. So that's going to be what I'm going to be keeping an eye out for next.
After the court's ruling, Manson's attorney, Howard King, released this statement to the media. The ruling is disappointing but not unexpected. The court telegraphed this outcome when it refused to consider the bombshell sworn declaration of former plaintiff Ashley Smithline, which detailed how women were systematically pressured by Evan Rachel Wood and Ilma Gore to make false claims about Brian Warner. The failure to admit this critical evidence, along with the court's decision to not consider Ms. Gore's iPad, the contents of which demonstrated how she and Ms. Wood crafted a forged FBI letter, will be the subject of an immediate appeal to the California Court of Appeal. And while it might not be clear, Evan and Ilma did not win the removal of four items from the lawsuit, one of which includes the sentence, quote, "to publicly cast plaintiff Brian Warner, professionally known as Marilyn Manson, as a rapist and abuser, a malicious falsehood that has derailed Warner's successful music, TV, and film career." But it does not appear Evan and Ilma will be appealing their losses, at least not according to this statement by Evan's attorney. He says, quote, "We are very pleased with the court's ruling, which affirms and protects Evan's exercise of her fundamental First Amendment rights. As the court correctly found, plaintiff failed to show that his claims against her have even minimal merit. For now, the judge gave a tentative trial date in May 2024. but because Manson is appealing the court's ruling, this will not be the date for trial. Because during an appeal, it puts a lawsuit on hold until the conclusion of appeal. If I had to speculate, we are not likely to see a trial until the spring or summer of 2025. We have a long road ahead of us, but this ruling is not the end.